recorded interview with Professor Philip E. Eaton on January 22, 1997, in his office at the University of Chicago. The interview is by James M. Trainum. Professor Eaton, I know from things I've read that you were born in Brooklyn, New York, June 2, 1936. Can you tell me something about your parents and your early childhood?
I'm not well to remember them particularly well. I started school, elementary school, in Brooklyn, CS 102, if I remember correctly. I was 7, I believe. My parents decided that we should move permanently to a summer home, which we had in New Jersey, a small town called Bud Lake. And we left Brooklyn. The driving force behind this was my father had a small factory that dealt with the printing of cloth.
May I interrupt you a moment?
Yes, of course. My father had a small factory in Brooklyn that dealt with the screen printing of cloth and the lithographic process that he had invented for doing direct printing on cloth. It was a non-unionized factory, and at the time, as I understand it, the unions in Brooklyn were very corrupt. And every time my father opened the factory, each day the employees would come in and they would then put a large steel door across the entrance and lock it, so the union gangsters could not get in. One day someone forgot to lock the door, the gangsters got in and threatened my father. When he went home that night, he locked the door for the last time, and we moved to New Jersey. My father was a very inventive man. He started his business at the depth of the Depression and built it from nothing, like something quite substantial. Very ingenious fellow. My mother was a loving housewife and a good mother that I enjoyed very much in doing. As I say, when I was about 7, we moved from New York to Bud Lake, this small town in New Jersey, about 50 miles northwest of New York. My father opened his business in a town nearby.
Did you continue in the same business?
Yes. And it was a reasonably long period of time. The area that we moved to was very much a rural area. In the summertime, it was a vacation area for people from New York, but in the winter, it was quite deserted. I had a 10-mile ride each way to school in a small town called Soxana. Actually, quite a nice school, and I enjoyed it very much. It was an interesting transition from New York to Brooklyn to this small town, and I remember very distinctly having to take an examination to decide what grade I would be in. I did very well on this examination, except that I could not distinguish from pictures the difference between a mouse and a rat, having seen neither one of them in Brooklyn. And in any case, I skipped a couple of grades and got started in fourth grade right off the bat. In school, had very dedicated teachers, I must say. It was to turn out that I was the first of the high school graduates from the area to go on to a major institution for further education. But I was asked anyway to put down the education I got at Roxbury High School. They were really quite good, and I had some very fond memories of teachers there. I was thinking about it this morning, and I actually remember from fourth grade that Mrs. Iloff, whose name I can't spell, actually Miss Iloff and Miss Gato, both general science teachers. And most particularly, a teacher in freshman year of high school, Mrs. Mendez, M-E-N-D-E-S, who even now I keep in contact with. She introduced me to the outer world, took me to opera in New York. She taught an interesting combination of courses, Latin and family, home family, or something like that. And she very much had a picture of civilization. It was quite different from what was normally found in small towns in New Jersey. She was very important in that element. And that pretty much does it. I was one of the few in high school that was really stimulated by the courses in science. There were half a dozen others in the class, and about 130 people. We all banded together and enjoyed things, and went on to the National Honor Society and things of that sort. We were not appreciated by our fellow students who had different things. But I think that's typical of what happens.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that you wanted to study chemistry when you left high school?
Oh, yes. I was very early on a teacher in the basement with chemicals. And, my parents were quite supportive of this, the chemistry vets and so on. I went perhaps a little bit too fast. I remember snitching some money from my father and sort of, quotation marks, secretly ordering various flasks of that sort. Ultimately being found out, being penalized by having my laboratory shut down for a year. It taught me a very good lesson about honesty. Even if I was pursuing thievery in a higher interest, my parents always encouraged me. This way, I remember very distinctly my father taking me to New York to a small place that sold scientific instruments. My first microscope, and I was always interested then in biology and chemistry. Later it became a focus in chemistry. And although my father was quite strict in terms of making me walk around the house, mow the lawn, and help him in his factory and things of that sort, I was never under any pressure to take over the business. You know, I was the only son. He always was quite supportive of going on in education. You know, he himself was self-educated. I'm not even sure if he had a high school degree.
And your mother, what education level did she
move? I'm not sure if she finished high school.
Mm-hmm.
But both my parents read. We got many magazines in the house, daily newspapers. And this kind of thing was rather uncommon in that area of the country at the time. 50 miles from New York in the 40s was considered an enormous distance. But the area now is a bedroom commuter suburb.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went back there some years ago, I was dumbfounded by how it had changed.
Well, when you graduated from high school, did you have any hesitation about going on to the university, or was that definitely
in the plan? No, it was clear that I was going to do that. Some years earlier, my parents had taken me to Princeton University. Princeton was on the way to Atlantic City from where we lived. And we toured the campus, and I remember again quite distinctly that at that time Firestone Library was being built at Princeton. And the workmen there were hand-cutting the stones to do this. It impressed me tremendously. I still, in fact, had a mental picture of that. And clearly I wanted to go to Princeton. It was well located. It had a good reputation and so on and so forth. And although I was admitted to numerous other places, Princeton was the one I wanted and the one I went to. And I think it was a very good choice.
Well, yes. What do you recall specifically, if anything, about your education at Princeton worth recording?
Yes. There again, it was an interesting experience. I came into Princeton, from this somewhat backwater country school at a time that the majority of the students at Princeton were prep school graduates, Exeter, and whatnot. And it was a little disconcerting for me. I was helped in that when I was a junior in high school, my parents sent me to Europe on an assignment in international living. And I lived for a summer in France. And after my senior year in high school, I did the same thing in England. This gave me some kind of a reasonable background of how to handle more cultured people. And the group that I traveled with was a very good group of people. But still, the person was quite a shock, and it was an interesting assessment to make. I certainly had some trouble in the freshman year, because the chemistry and everything that I had in high school was not competitive with that many of the prep school people. But I was admitted to the honors chemistry course, and in due course did quite well, and graduated some personality. It was interesting, for instance, that at the time, and I think probably even nowadays, and the undergraduates were easily incorporated into research programs. And I did some research with Dick Hill, who was retired, but he was a delightful person who really helped me understand what science was about. And I enjoyed that very much. At the same time, in the summers, I did work in industry at Allied Chemical, and this came about in a strange way, I suppose. When my mother broke her hip, the dog pulled it over, and she went to the hospital and shared a room with the wife of the vice president of Allied Chemical. And by the time she came home, I had a job at Allied Chemical, mothers being what mothers are. And this actually worked out beautifully, just beautifully, because I worked every summer from my sophomore year in college through my graduate work at Harvard at Chemical, and they helped to send me to graduate school about equipment and things of that sort. And that was an awful experience. The people there really understood industrial chemistry and taught me a lot. Terms of technique, and it has stood me very good stead over the years. And in particular, one person there, Edward Gilbert, really had a major impact on my career, and perhaps we can come back to that later, and I'll show you how the introduction occurred. But one thing I should mention about Gilbert, he was a group leader, and he had a very accurate picture of what was useful industrially. And he used to say, if you can't do the reaction on the steam bath in a 250-milliliter Erlenmeyer, it'll never be useful. And it taught me a lot about how to handle compounds. And nowadays, of course, we don't ever do reaction on stuff that's that large. But still, it was an attitude that was very important. And the whole experience at Allied was very useful. So it coincided very nicely with my education. And indeed, the work I did at Allied Chemical concerned, for the most part at the time, a compound called ketone, which was being developed by Allied as an insecticide against the fire ant. And in fact, afterwards, it was used extensively as an insecticide against the fire ant. It was banned 2 years ago, because as a fluorocarbon is not degraded easily, and there are worries about it being carcinogen and so on and so forth. And it's rather interesting that the fire ants are back to being a major problem. There are no good chemicals to use against it. But more to the point, this compound ketone is a cage compound. And I got involved in cage chemistry very early. In a formal sense, ketone is a bishomoketone. And I can probably trace everything I've done in chemistry back to this problem in ketone. It's a long, tedious, tortuous story. But there really is an intellectual connection between the two. So this whole business with my mother breaking her hip and going to the hospital and how that couple really worked out one day. And I very much understand the purpose of putting mothers on one pedestal. Sure.
When you were at Princeton, I believe you did a research project.
And it's with Dick Hill. And this actually concern some cyclic compounds that one could get from diethyl benzyl acetone. And I had occasion recently to go back and look at my thesis, my senior thesis, and was reminded that in these compounds, solvent was encapsulated in the structure. And at the time, all we knew that we had these solvents and that we could not get the solvent molecule out, and we left it at that. And it was a very foolish decision, because years later, Cram won the Nobel Prize, which was in, of course, for these encapsulations and so on. And I think really it was the same phenomenon. I wasn't ready to follow it up, but I don't think Dick Hill saw it in that same light. In retrospect, it would have been many years before his time had we picked him up and done something with it.
The title of your senior thesis included a reference to cyclopentadiene or dicyclopentadiene.
In my senior thesis, no, in my PhD thesis, but not in my senior thesis. Senior thesis title. Oh, you're quite right. Exactly. No, that's wrong. Actually, the one that's there. That title is in my senior thesis. In my PhD thesis. The actual title of my senior thesis was Organic Vitamins.
Okay.
Junior paper. That's getting difficult.
Well, you were so productive in those.
I'm not even sure.
You were so productive in those days. It's hard to
pick out. Yes, here we go. Yes, the title of my senior thesis was "Giant Ring Diether Ketones: Applications of Conformational Analysis." As I said, I reread this recently. I understand the chemistry now much better than I did then. But I was truly distressed to read, to see how poorly I wrote at that time, and I hope it has improved.
I have shared the same feeling as I look back at my dissertation. I would not accept it from one of my students today. When you graduated from Princeton, did you have any idea about graduate school other than Harvard, or was your focus so
on
that?
No, it was pretty much focused on Harvard. My interest at the time was in physical organic chemistry. And it turned out my definition of physical organic chemistry, or my thought as to what physical organic chemistry was very different from what it really was. I had always been fascinated by literally the physical properties of organic compounds. Where they melted, how they melted, things of that sort. And it seemed to me that physical organic chemistry would be something that I considered that. I was dumbfounded when I got to Harvard and found that physical organic chemistry had to do with things like ionization and arrow pushing the mechanisms and things of that sort. My education at Princeton, although in fact many of the people at Princeton have come from Harvard, but my education at Princeton exceedingly classical. Basically, it's Lasso chemistry instead of mechanistic chemistry, and you learned a lot of reactions, a lot of structures, but you knew very little about how these things proceeded. And so Harvard was a real shock. It was certainly the place to go, and I think four of the chemistry majors went to Harvard. All of us had a shock, but ultimately it did very well. I really don't remember if I... Oh, yes, I did at least apply to Yale. after that, I went and I visited it again at Stirling Laboratory. And Stirling Laboratory, which was back to, well, almost 40 years. Stirling Laboratory at Yale was awful. I think I once said I would not take a pee there. It was so dirty. And I don't think it changed much in the last 40 years, but Yale people have really had a burden that way. So much so that I would not have considered going to Yale. I don't remember by a final square, probably MIT. But the Harvard thing came through very recently. So I said, yeah. And I was perfectly happy. I enjoyed it very much. I had a struggle with some people there who were much smarter than I was. But in fact, looking back, I just picked up. Particularly in that I was already a superb experimenter because of the history. And that was the way to endear yourself to any professor. To be good in the laboratory and know how to handle various bits of apparatus. And I've always been very adventurous with the laboratory work. So I had no problem getting along. Because I had these problems from industry, this background in industry, I was quite eager to continue some of that work. And when I came to Harvard and talked to the various professors about doing this, most were very much against this. They wanted to give me new problems. And it was quite interesting at the time in working with Paul Bartlett, who was the leader in physical chemistry in the world. And I thought very highly of his work. But when I talked to him, he would agree to allow me to work on this project that I was bringing to the university for the maximum 6 months, and then I went to switch to one of his projects. A younger man on the faculty, a non-tenure man, was Peter Yates. And Peter, Professor Yates, because I certainly called him Professor Yates, was much more amenable to taking on this project that I had in the industry. He was quite useful. Interested in it, and so I decided to work with him. Many years later, I was having a long chat with Paul Bartlett, and we became friends over the years, and he said to me, and a comment that I treasured, is that one of the mistakes he had made in life was not allowing me to do my project with him. And that's I always had a very rosy feeling.
I'm sure you do.
At that point, Yates was a very interesting advisor, very thoughtful, very helpful. I played bridge with him most every night, and that was very interesting education with him. He was smart enough to recognize, in fact, quite brilliant. To recognize that an incidental observation that I had made in the laboratory, which came from all of this business with the chloroplasts and the chemicals, related very much to the mechanism of the enrollment reaction. It's a reaction that at the time was being looked at very closely by Woodward and Catherine. And I had noticed that the arrangement reaction that was catalyzed by aluminum chloride. And I remember, again, Peter Douglas considering this observation and then saying, if this is the case, then all the reaction itself should be catalyzed by the aluminum chloride. And indeed, I proceeded into an investigation of this area, demonstrated that a reaction which was long thought to be uncatalyzed was in fact catalyzed by Lewis Atkins. Particularly the reaction between dienes and dienophile contain oxygen. And this, in fact, was a very important observation. Over the years, although I did it after the initial observation, I didn't follow it up, but over the years it has become extremely important in organic synthesis. A very significant fraction that deals with all the reactions in organic synthesis are now carried out with Lewis acid. Catalysis and even an angiospecific synthesis done by replacing the Lewis acid, the non-chiral Lewis acid, aluminum chloride, with a chiral Lewis acid, and so on. And this has had really a major impact in the overall chemistry. the initial discussion was mine. The initial discussion was certainly Professor Yeager's recognizing the importance of an observation. And that has always had a powerful influence on me to think deeply about every observation. It may have more significance of the trivial thing than that is for me. And that's been helpful.
Anything else specific about your graduate education you recall or want to record?
Well, I found some things were amusing. I took some of the, or I had taken, I should say, some of the very early NMR paper. Harvard had one of the early machines that I needed. Harvard Organic Group was always fairly primitive in terms of their instrumentation. And when they got an NMR machine, it was about 1969, 1960, I think. At that time, air conditioning was very rare. I remember that you had to work in this room and your babies would get so hot. And my thesis, my PhD, has some of the very early NMR spectrum. And I remember very distinctly at my oral examination, Gates and Woodward arguing ferociously about the interpretation of the spectrum. As the years went by, I realized that an NMR became more sophisticated and that both of them were wrong. And so, you see how techniques are useful. Indeed, some of my colleagues went on for a few years to be NMR jocks. And then something very much more simple NMR machines came out. And everybody could look when they ended up out of the seat. Harvard was a good experience. A great group of people who really expected to produce and do it one. The interactions between students and different disciplines at that time was very strong and very useful. I don't think it's quite like that now.
When you graduated from Harvard with your PhD degree, did you go directly into academic employment?
Again, the situation then was very different than it is now. A few stories come to mind. Before I went home the last summer, before I got to write my thesis, it was simple that I would go home because I would work at Allied Chemical, which was near to my home. And in fact, my support for students, of course, was non-existent. When I went to Harvard Graduate School, I had a teaching assistantship, but I had to pay my tuition, and Harvard insisted on a bond before they would take me, and all the students had to do that. Not like nowadays when most graduate students are panting for students and do anything to get them there. In any case, before I went home, Peter said to me, you'll have to think about what you want to do. And I mentioned something about maybe doing a postdoc in Europe. And Peter's comment was, do you want to ski or do you want to go to the music festival? He had absolutely no thought that I should do a postdoc in Europe. But he did think that I should go into the academic world. Said so. And I was very surprised. It was really not a common occurrence that people went into the academic world. And since I had these very close relationships with Allied Chemical, I had always assumed that I would go into the industrial world. And it wasn't the world I had a great deal of respect for, both because of my interest. Then I was raised by a father who was very much a businessman, and I liked things like that. And I said to Yates that, I thought I was going to go into industry. And Yates said to me, you go home and think about it this summer. And if you still want to go into industry, then come back. It's an extraordinary statement. And of course, I went home and I thought, I came back. And I said, okay, let's see what you're talking about.
That was before you completed your doctoral
assignment? Yes, exactly. Of course, I was needed to play both ends of the stick because you had to have a job of one sort or another. And one of the places, one of the industrial places that was interested in interviewing me, and the industrial interviewers then were very much like industrial interviewers. When they came to Harvard, they looked around and they invited you out if they were interested in. But one of these places was Hooker Chemical. And of course, they were very interested in me because Hooker was the manufacturer of hexachlorocyclopentadiene, which is the compound that goes into making ketones. And I was pretty much the world expert on the chemistry of the molecules of chlorine, because part of the thesis was involved in these chlorocarbons because of the connection of the chemical. And so Hooker asked me to come out for an interview. And this was strange. I flew from Boston, supposedly to Buffalo, where Hooker was. And this was on a Friday in the winter. And Buffalo was snowed in, as it often is now. And instead of landing in Buffalo, we landed in Chicago. So they're very different time. And the airlines offered bus service from Chicago back to Buffalo. And this was a Friday, which was hopeless. So that was not going to arrive in time for the interview. Some months earlier, Michael Dewar, who was at the University of Chicago as a faculty member, had spoken at Harvard. And I was absolutely enchanted by Michael. I thought he just gave this fabulous talk. Fabulous. And he was a fantastic character and so on. And so since I found myself in Chicago, I was one of the eager young men, I called up from the airport because I had nothing else to do. I couldn't go out of Chicago. I called up his office here. And got his secretary, who was a charmer, who used to, in fact, be a Folies Bergère dancer. And it turned out that Michael was at DePaul University. And I was just kind of taking a chance to be lucky enough to talk with him. You know. His secretary was definitely on the phone. She called him at DePaul. He was absolutely delighted that he had an excuse for that, especially today. Before, which was kind of terribly dull. And so he canceled his plans there, came back to the university. I came in from the airport. And I spent an afternoon with him, and then the evening with Michael and his wife, Mary. And I enjoyed this scientifically. And I remember they were living in one of the townhouses here, 57th or 55th Street, going there for dinner. And they were pretty big drinkers. And I had a scotch. I was not much on drinking. I had a scotch to be appropriately copious. And every time I would take a sip of the scotch, Michael would fill it right back up to the top, like the Japanese. And by about 10 o'clock or something in the evening, when I had to go back to O'Hare, I was just totally lost. It was embarrassing. And again, I have this picture of my son drinking my own. In any case, as part of the conversation, Michael enjoyed talking with me and offered me a postdoctoral position here. So when I got back to Harvard, Peter Yates asked me how things were, and who hooked me. I said, I never got it. I got a postdoc with Dewar. So that seemed like he would accept it. Was to turn out, Peter went to an American Chemical Society meeting, I think on the West Coast, and clearly talked to people quickly. A few days after he got back from this meeting, I got a telegram out of the blue from Berkeley offering me an assistant professorship at Berkeley. Very short telegram offering me an assistant professorship. Stated the salary, which was, I don't know, something like $65 a year, something like that, and giving me 24 hours to make up my mind. Very different from what goes on nowadays, where departments spend untold amounts of money and time interviewing people and so on and so forth. But in any case, I decided to take the position, of course, and so I went directly from my PhD to a professorship. Had quite a good time. Assistant professors at Berkeley, quite different from assistant professors at Berkeley. First of all, the assistant professor title was different from an instructorship, only because assistant professors were allowed to get on the campus to hunt for a parking spot. And instructors were not even allowed to come on campus with their cars. I don't think there was any difference in salary, but it was an important thing to get on the campus. The rule at Berkeley was fantastic. The rules written by the state. For example, assistant professors were allowed to have desks that only had drawers on one side. And their visitors' chairs could not have arms.
Was this status symbol or a kind of...
No, I think it was the state trying to cut down the costs or something mm-hmm. of this sort. Everybody thought these schools were ludicrous, but they were still pretty good. The experience at Berkeley was exceptional. I had a substantial teaching load. In fact, I taught elementary organic chemistry with Melvin Calvin, just recently passed away. I really shouldn't say with Melvin Calvin. Basically, I taught the course, and Melvin was gifted as a teacher. He basically didn't do a damn thing. It was quite infuriating to me. On the other hand, Berkeley provided me everything I needed to do my research. After a big argument with the department secretary, I actually got a key to the stock room. It was fantastic. And no problems with things of that sort. They were very generous. Except that at the time at Berkeley, the young organic chemists were not permitted to have graduate students. The senior organic chemists, Ford, Case, Dalvin, Noyes, took all the graduates. And, of course, I resented this, as did the other citizens. All of us had 2-year appointments, and it was very typical that nobody got the renewal of the 2-year appointment. As it was not the turn, I did very well at Berkeley, and I think I was the first of the young to get an appointment. But that reappointment still came without graduate students. At that point, ludicrous, as I said to them at the time. I've done the experiment in the first 2 years to see if I can do research by myself. And now it's time for me to do the next experiment to do research with students. But there was no changing their rule. And in any case, it wasn't that important to me because Chicago was looking for people. Michael Dewey was still here. Was to turn out Michael left before I came, but Michael was still here. He remembered the whole incident in Chicago, thought I was terrific, and he brought me here to Chicago. They made me an offer, and since an offer at Chicago was very different from an offer at Berkeley, in Chicago, young people were really part of the faculty, not just people that we knew. And of course, if I came to Chicago, I was allowed to compete for graduate students and so on. And from my point of view, that was terrific. And also, as I said at the time, Chicago was several thousand miles closer to civilization than San Francisco and Berkeley 35 years ago. San Francisco, uncivilized. Now, I was still a New York boy. So I chose to come to Chicago. To Berkeley's actually amazing. Remember the chairman at Berkeley saying to me, "How could you possibly go to Chicago? It's on the wrong side of the tracks," referring to the location. I can fly, but at least it's on the right side of the Rockies. and I never regretted Berkeley. Berkeley is an extraordinary school, but at the time, it was really bound up in traditions and things that were ludicrous. And again, looking at the differences, at the time of Berkeley, most of the assistant professors had come from major Ivy League schools, in particular Harvard. Harvard at the time, when we were students, had cumulative examinations. I think so. Berkeley was always debating, should we have cumulative exams? And so there was a faculty meeting. Very, very rare at Berkeley for there to be faculty meetings. And the discussion came up about cumulative returns, and the vote was taken, and since there were lots of assistant professors, all from Harvard and all assistant professors before it, the vote was overwhelmingly for introduction of cumulative exams. At which point the chairman stood up, dismissed the junior faculty, and another vote was taken, and that was that. There were no cumulative exams. That's very different from what happened at Chicago, and why I really love Chicago. In Chicago, the junior faculty has the same say as the senior faculty. And even nowadays, the senior faculty look to the junior faculty to change things, to introduce new things. And the only place here that a junior faculty man does not have the same vote as a senior faculty man is on internal promotions to ranks higher. But if you're trying to bring in a full professor from outside, and we can't decide whether or not to make the offer, the junior man has the same vote, and it's a secret ballot. And this, I think, is a terrific system. It really distinguishes Chicago from most universities in the world.
Do you think your unexpected leaving Berkeley prompted them to make any changes?
Oh, indeed it did, because the next person in, I've forgotten if it was Kirby Shearer or Clay Hefcott, but things changed fantastically. They were allowed to have students, and it really woke Berkeley up to the fact that the times were changing, and you could not use people as they were doing at the time. I must say, however, again, things always look different in retrospect. The 2 years that I spent doing research on my own without students proved to be very, very important to me. I did a terrific job during the time. That was kind of when we looked at the photodimerization of cyclopentenone and its mechanism and things of that sort, and really put 2+2 photocycloaddition reactions on their feet. I did it myself. And when it came time, when I came here to work with graduate students, I was very confident about telling students what I thought they should do. Very confident when they would come and tell me it didn't work, tell me I should go back and bury this or bury that. And I could not be intimidated by the students. I think now, in many places, including starting faculty members are immediately inundated with graduate students. They want lots of hands. They want to do this kind of interaction with graduate students, but I don't think they ever really get the chance to prove to themselves that they know what they're doing. And I think, in fact, the Berkeley system was certainly not put together for this reason, for helping the assistant professors put together for reasons that were sufficient. But I think, in fact, the net result of the system is far better. I really prefer a situation in which second year assistant professors were supported, didn't particularly have to worry about the grade problems. And that's probably true nowadays, but also had to do it themselves. I think that they would find it would be very helpful to them as they moved ahead.
Have you recommended that here?
No, I've talked about it here. There is a problem in this country now that if you do things differently, requiring more of students, requiring something different than assistant professors, that unless everybody else is going to do it, so you can't get away from it. You can't win. It's a very unfortunate situation that the competition for faculty members, the competition for graduate students, postdocs, and so on, has risen to a level that it's difficult to change. It's difficult to be different, which is unfortunate. I always thought one of the advantages of Chicago was that it could afford to be different, but times change.
the University of Chicago. What research program did you initiate or continue?
I have to go back a little bit to where I was at Berkeley, and for that matter, where I was in my PhD work. As I've mentioned, my PhD work focused on compounds which were heavily substituted by chlorine, the chlorocarbons. And I had tried to address some of the structural problems that we met at the time, incrementally, going beyond IR, which was the tool at the time, as I already said, NMR, only rarely, and of course was useless at the time, because compounds were full of chlorine, and hydrogen. This was well before the time of carbon NMR. There was something called nuclear quadrupole spectroscopy, which was useful, had the potential of being useful for chlorocarbons. It was a technique that Al Cotton had done some things with at MIT. And of course, I was adventurous with stuff like this. So I built a nuclear quadrupole spectrometer and tried to use it for the identification and structure of these chlorocarbons. And I remember this adventure with electronics. The only thing I ever managed, the only signal I ever managed to get from the nuclear quadrupole spectrometer was the Boston police station. It was really quite fun. When I went to Berkeley, NMR was really starting to become a powerful technique, and I realized that I didn't have a chance to compete if I stuck with chlorocarbons, because I could not use NMR. So then the question came, could we make cage compounds that were hydrogen instead of chlorine, using some of the methodology which had been developed in the chlorocarbon series? And at that time, what was known about the photochemistry about the beta unsaturated ketones led me to the idea that yes, we could use this method to do what is now called 2+2 photocyclobutanes. Cyclobutanes, and if you set the compound up correctly, you could perhaps get each compound. I started this work very innocently, just looking at photodimorphism and cyclobutanes. And that happens to be a good reaction. It gives what was unexpected at the time, a mixture of the head-to-head and the head-to-tail cyclobutane compounds. Very much a same theory at the time. And this was at the stage. This was at the time that Joel Kennan was developing sensitized reactions. There were many arguments. What was going to be going on in photochemistry? Some reactions were thought to go from single cells, some reactions were thought to go from triplets, and maybe they were mixtures. And the first investigation that we made was physical organic investigation of the dimerization of cyclobutanes, because there was the suspicion that part of it was happening on single state, part of it was happening on triple state, because the reaction was very concentration dependent. And you could make an argument, as Peter Leermakers did early on, that the concentration dependence had to do with the lifetime of the single state versus the lifetime of the triple state, one being much shorter than the other. And then we did some classical tests along these lines, and that was true. And we later found out that, in fact, the concentration effect was in reality a solvent effect. Because as you change the concentration of cyclopentenone, you were, in essence, changing the polarity of the solvent. And we started then to understand more about the mechanism of cyclopentenone dimerization. And we could conclude, I thought, from the results, that since the direction of the addition was not being controlled by the presence of a carbon in both parts, that maybe you could do a cycloaddition between an oxidized unsaturated ketone and a simple O without carbon. And it turned out that was true. It was the first demonstration, the addition of cyclopentenone to cyclopentenone. first demonstration of an intermolecular addition of an oak. Almost the same time, Corning looked at cyclohexanone to unactivate an overcome. It was critically important by Paul DeMeo. Works together really were the thought very that would have happened. And it's not just the dimerization. The dimerization of enome extends work in the early 1900s in Italy on that was all solid state work and was always considered to be very special. There's other work that was done in the 60s with cyclopentene and cyclohexanone. Really put the difference in that position. We made it a statement. And of course, our work on it did a lot to establish the method. And we were able to show that, in fact, it really did require a moderate size ring, five membered ring, and six membered ring. It's a higher ring, you can do a different chemistry, photoisomerization. It's highly similar molecules, and this fit my general interest in strain compounds. Very unlike typical organic compounds. And of course, in these trace compounds that we were working on, we had the same sort of thing. Geometry, unlike usual geometry. Together helped define where I went.
So that's what you started off with in Chicago?
When I came to Chicago, we were wanted to understand more about the chemistry of cyclopentadiene, which was potentially a very important precursor of cage compounds with hydrogen. We knew a little bit about a tetrachlorocyclopentadiene known and then I wanted to be driven to make this switch from chlorocarbon to the hydrogen system. And so much of the earlier work here was on cyclopentadiene known how they might be made and how they might be used. And one of the ideas that we had, as we were looking at these cyclopentadiene knowns dimerize very easily, spontaneously, and we investigated a little bit of that earlier. The dimers of these compounds, if exposed to light, ultraviolet light, undergo an internal photocyclization, which is a cage compound. And it's exactly the kind of reaction that we had discovered much earlier at Allied Chemical. You give these cage compounds. And the cage compounds are closely related to the insecticide. But now they have hydrogen on them instead of chlorine, and we really start looking at them more and understand the structure. And there was a reaction that was coming into vogue at the time, the Fogorsky reaction, which dealt with ring reactions of alpha halo ketones. And in fact, at a cumulative examination at Harvard, I never did very well in cumulative at Harvard, but one of the tests had a reaction that has been extracted from the literature by some observations that Pope and there's a Duncan problem, but it had to be dealt with. It was fundamentally a focus. And I remember when I had the problem with the human, I had no idea what was going on. But later I found out the answer, and I was quite fascinated. The usual thing is the ones you get wrong are the ones that you remember. And literally, 4 years later, I recognized that this thing from that classroom could be combined with the information that we had in the halogenated cages and the information that we had from the non-halogenated cages. And maybe it was related to the feedback system, which, of course, at that time was enormously fantastic goal. There was always something bad around. Everybody had proposals for how to make qubits. And I looked at this. I realized that this is true. This is the story that I presented at the time. And I think it is true. It wasn't really the question of did this reaction work to get the qubank system, but rather, did we finally know enough about the cyclopentadienone chemistry, the halogen compound chemistry, the prototype chemistry, that we could actually make exactly the right intermediate that was necessary to try the proposed reaction on. And I thought that was the challenge. And we sort of conceived it. 2 weeks later, we had done the whole thing. Interestingly, Kirby Shearer, who was at Berkeley, a graduate student at Harvard a year or two behind me, worked at Harvard with different micro fluorocarbons. That very same thing that I had worked in the chemistry. And when he went to Berkeley, one of his ideas was to try to do this with Pavlovsky contraction. On the fully chlorinated material, which was very readily available. And he called me, and he was here asking me if we had tried or were doing this reaction on the fully chlorinated material. And I said, I said, no, we have left the area. We went on to try this with the chlorocarbon, and it turned out, at least right now, in this thing, it doesn't work on the chlorocarbon. It needs to go. We had it. We don't think too soon. Which is unfortunate. Kirby is now very ill. Anyhow, that's how we got in. As you say, there is this line all the way down to my job at the
So you had not deliberately chosen cubane as a target molecule. It just happened that it looked like an intriguing target associated with the chemistry you were already investigating.
Cubane had a natural and obvious relationship to the kinds of compounds we were working with. And we had certainly composed, I would say, a more classical chemical approach from where we were to the cubane system. A more stepwise approach through various intermediates that we were never able to get. By that approach, it turns out that many, many years later, we made those same machines, ones that we wanted to make qubane, but the only way we could make them was from qubane stuff. And the reaction that we had proposed years earlier to take these reactions to qubane, in fact, they don't work. It's in a much more complicated chemistry. Because other very simple, the other reactions, all the voice control, all very, very effective.
I believe the graduate student that was associated with you on that qubane synthesis was Thomas Perry. Was he your first graduate student?
Yes, he was my first graduate student. He was in deep trouble here. He was working with Jackson Brown, retired from many years ago. And he was a fairly poor student. He was actually quite a poor student at the time, and he was about to be let go. And thought I'd give him a chance. He was one of my first people. Tom actually made kind of a precursor of molecules. I was working myself very actively at the time. I'm taking away from Tom the basic the first round through the first recognition and this Cuba by accident, the first time something was made. There was something else. Tom was a delightful person. Around, has gone on to be very it's a side story, certainly, but the term black, Chicago, of course, has never discriminated. And Tom and I had many interesting discussions about civil rights and the black and white relationship. That was, of course, in the early 60s. Remember very strongly when he told Tom to make use of that he was black. He was sufficiently a realist to do this. Not as affirmative action or anything of that. Not Tom was very confident first. So he never made demands on people. You know, you should do this for me because I am black. But he was smart enough to recognize that since he was black, certain opportunities would open up and go with him. And he went from here to Atlanta University. And Atlanta was a black university. And rose up and did very well in the if I remember correctly, got up to be provost and went to West Virginia, which is basically a white university. President and now he's back at Atlanta University, expanded from figuring out president there, and it's been superb. Very proud of him. And he chose the right thing to do. I think that he enjoyed the dream. And at that time, we had one of the 60 going downstairs and taking the spectrum. Just after the spectrum had been recorded of this compound, which there were just two lines. One line was the hydrogen of two leptons of cubane dimethyl ester, the other line was hydrogen of the tubal system. And it's a fantastic spectrum, it's just these two lines. And just what the significance of the fun when Gerhard Claus was my colleague at the time and saw Winstein walked in. Winstein was a karate master, he had just arrived, and he was being shown around the department by Gerhard. And so they came up with the spectrometer, and everybody saw these two lines, of course, and you know, we all realized they got to be a fun. It was a very then I went back up to the lab because I, you know, being interested in what it goes down as fast as I wanted to see if I could improve the yield. So I kept eluding that from the chromatography count. The next thing that came out, it turned out to be the dimethyl ester for phthalates. Had I not done this chromatography, I would have. And then a more, much more complicated, would have had these aromatic protons in it. I would have changed the whole molecule out of all one part. Because the mixture of the two things together would make no sense at all in the end. It would absolutely seem like that I did this chromatography. And interestingly, although we have done the same reaction hundreds of times since then, we have never, ever gotten this aromatic ester out. And I just, I have no idea where it came from. You know, phthalates are contaminants all over the place, but the S, they're not the methyl esters, they're the long-term esters of that. This was not, I've never seen that again. I have all kinds of theories. So it was a real bit of luck. I must say, God sometimes really smiles on heaven. Certainly.
Some unsuspected and yet unknown promoter for this rearrangement.
Right. I've never seen it again. I don't understand it. I don't understand it at all. In any case, synthesis. I probably made an ass out of myself at many meetings, chemical meetings, things of that sort, with this synthesis and tubing. Because it was the first time, again, maybe I'm making an ass out of myself again, but it really was the first time that a very highly strained molecule, very contorted molecule, very unusual, it's the first time that a molecule like this has been synthesized in a logical way. Admittedly, there was an adventure in trying to take steps, but there were reasons. There were good reasons to try it, and the Pavlovsky reaction was known as a way of making cyclopropane, cyclobutane gases, and so on. And most of the cage compounds that had been made earlier, for example, was ketone molecule, was discovered totally accidentally. It was a massive reaction. Hexachlorous hypropentadiene was mixed with SO3, and how came this compound? And to this day, no one knows how that reaction works. Well, all the other key compounds, very nice stuff by Peter Gates, these were just irradiations, chemical irradiations of a kind of off the shelf. And boom, sort of a Shazam reaction about the case. The cage was not an expected product. It was rather the kind of thing. Let's see what happens with the irradiated compound X. Totally fishing expedition. So for this Q-bang business, we really had to start way back. The system approach at a time that synthetic methodology and logical synthesis was being developed for the natural products. Where was some logic to what was being done. And I remember really getting up on soapboxes at various meetings and things. And I'm sure some retrospective, I must have looked like a fool. I mean, here was 25 years, whatever it was, making pronouncements. But we have tried ever since then, if I say so myself, to approach the synthesis of these very novel molecules, of compounds that have geometry, far different from anything ordinary. But we've always tried to make these molecules by a logical synthetic scheme. Whether it's not just, let's cook it or press on it or radiate it. I mean, we use these techniques, but they are techniques that have some logic to them. I mean, it's quite unexpected. In what I call the Shazam techniques, where you have a bolt of lightning and A becomes Z, and you have absolutely no idea how it happened or why it happened, and it could just as well have become W.
In the Cubane synthesis, you actually have in the several step synthesis two Pavlovsky steps.
Yes.
And the first one was a very high yield.
Right.
And the last one, which is the last step to give you the docoboxylate, was a modest yield.
Oh, yes.
And that is associated with what do you think?
With a great mystery. With a very great mystery. Because the difference between these two phases is really quite spectacular. The first one is as close to quantitative as you can get. So it goes in moderately strong bays at room temperature very rapidly, essentially over immediately in 10% aqueous base. It was beautiful. The second one, under the best conditions, is 50% yield, and you have to go to much, much greater base, 40% base. And you have to do this at reflux, which is about 110 degrees, in order to get the type of thing you have to do. And it's not at all obvious what happens. The amount of strain energy which is introduced in the two very similar. And presumably it has some very subtle difference in geometry as the bond is posing. So we have worked very hard over the years investigating this second closure and trying to improve and build, and we have never been successful. We know a little bit about the typecasting reaction, but not much. One of the byproducts has a clue, and that is the ketone gets reduced to an alcohol. And mind you, this is happening in an aqueous phase, so there's no oxygen source of hydrogen. But yet the ketone is reduced, so somehow hydrogen is coming somewhere. The reaction also turns pitch black. My guess is that when the hydride comes from somewhere, the rest of it's black. And we have been trying to outsmart this, but I don't have to do it. It certainly is very important now. In the early days, we made a little bit of diester, diester, and converted it to cubane. It goes back many years, and we achieved what we wanted to achieve. And it was a synthetic compound. Rather like the natural product people say, oh yeah, there's something that. And he went on to something else, which is what we did. We went on to other things. In the mid-70s, there were some questions, some of the organic questions about the mechanism of metal-catalyzed ring-opening reactions in strain systems. And Jack Halpern and I, and Luigi Cazar, from Italy, went to Edison. We did a very nice project in which we used cubane to probe the mechanism of the reaction. But again, a small amount of cubane diester went along with it. There was no need to really work hard on the synthesis. Years later, it became very important to be, and I'll tell you what, it became very important to be able to make large amounts of cubane diester. Became a reaction of a pilot plant scale. Of course, on the pilot plant scale, I became 30% yield instead of 80% yield for Orsky culture. That's the big deal. That's a huge amount of work, not only here, but in industry, trying to figure out how to improve that reaction. But yet, it has always remained no idea what's going on. And now, cubane is making multi-pound lots. It's much more expensive than it should be if we knew how to do that last step correctly. Because the rest of the reactions are really quite good. Now, of course, the question is why? Why, why all of a sudden cubane is made amounts? And again, this traces back to this experience with Allied Chemical. That's the general chemical division of Allied Chemical, that should be fair. And this man, Everett Dupin, encouraged me with the chemistry show. He took early retirement from Allied Chemical, and because he was a very experimentalist, he took a job with the RDEC, which is Army Research Development and Engineering Command, or something like that, at Picatinny Arsenal, New Jersey, which is now called New Jersey. And he was very interested in Picatinny making new explosives. And he came up with this idea that cubane could perhaps be the basis of world chemistry. I was always fascinated by cubane chemistry because I followed my career and knew that he was in fact a really important person. He took great pleasure from following what I was doing. And he said that they had done some calculations at the Army and that they thought optimized would be a terrific
explosive.
Thank you for considering me, but we're doing everything. Just a bit of that time, Paul, the first, and of course, Tom was still fussing around in the laboratory, and they did indeed contact Tom, and I don't know whether or not they actually did anything with him, but anyway, nothing happened. And some years later, Everett again contacted me that the Army was interested in
New Orleans.
and Gary was trying to make a measure of the and they were trying to entice me into this department. So they asked me to come to a meeting at Hilton Head, the workshop on high energy. And I knew, of course, that Gilbert was going to be there. He was very interested. There's a group of many of people passing around. And since I really felt a great love for this man, we took cubane dioxide in a few weeks. We took it, turned it over to a cubane, 1,4-dinitrate, 1,4-dinitrate cubane. A very simple thing with chemistry, there's no problem at all. And 1,4-dinitrate cubane, a nice, pretty material. So I arrived at this meeting, and I thought, what would I do with it? Of 1,4-dinitrate compound as a gift to Gilbert. So I gave this to him at the meeting, and there was a fantastic smile, followed by the most hanged jaw look you can imagine. Because apparently they had been contracting Gary, to make 1,4-dinitrate. Gary had been able to make it. Well, I would be badly over that. So it was very embarrassing. People were calling him. Gary gave it a talk. It made me feel kind of bad. And here I arrived with 100 milligrams as a gift. In any case, there were further discussions at the time in the army. You know, you didn't want to pursue this. And the thing that got, there were two things that got me interested in it as a real problem. And I had thought initially that the conception that octanite and cubane would be used in explosives was based on the fact that cubane had a high amount of extra energy and string energy. And that the formula was nice to blow off the CO2 and nitrogen. It turns out that was not the major part of the reason in this company. And as was explained to me at this meeting, density enters into how effective an explosive is in a variety of ways. And the first thing is obvious, how much stuff can you get into the shell, the limited volume of the shell. But the second thing is trivial. It turns out that the velocity of the shockwave goes through an explosive. That is, the velocity increases as the square of the distance. The velocity is faster, you get the energy out faster and faster. And that's very important. You get the energy out in a shorter period of time. So that's an excellent thing. Now, it turns out that cubane is an enormously dense hydrogen. It's 1.29. And at the time, it was by far the most dense hydrocarbon known. Since then, there have been a few other things that could be drained too, and in the polycubanes. But it turns out that molecular volume is a group additive property. And so if you know the density of the compound, and you know what you're going to find instead of hydrogen, you can do a fairly good job of calculating what the density of the compound is. And the army people had done this, and they calculated the density of the compound, and it's very common. And then they put two together. They probably got a little bit more support because they were very enthusiastic about this. And they concluded that the cost of the density would be 10, 15, depending on how enthusiastic you are, 25, 40 better than 8%. And that's an enormous improvement. That is the real push. I go back from this meeting to my group and told my group that they wanted us to make Dr. Knight. I was sort of laughing at this at the time. And my group was laughing at it. And we sit there in the seminar. And all of a sudden I got embarrassed. It's true, because I realized I didn't have to fight it like this. I had to make Dr. Knight's Cubane money. I knew how to make the dinitro compound because it's a diaphragm, and that's just a piece of trivial piece. But to make octanitro cubane, you'd have to take the rest of the hydrogen and put on the nitro piece. And there was no such chemistry that was existing. It was hard enough with a little hydrogen cyclohexane. Still, that's introduced in something like polycyclobutane. No way. Any sort of systematic chemistry. The approach to time is highly technical. You went all the way back to square one and you built it up from square one. And Cuban, that was never going to happen. There's no way you're going to go back to the natural cycle of the domain. But sometimes it is still unknown in Triton's chemistry. And so, since I realized I did not know how to make a natural Cuban, I didn't know how to make anything Cuban. And we were supposed to be the world's experts on human chemistry and on the chemistry in general
of these strange molecules.
Yeah, I may now that I think about it,
it's a great decision. We would stop making these molecules, but really get to look at the chemistry of the molecules. And we would take cubane or cubane diester as a starting material. And we would go from there. And we were then able to work out ways of doing systematic substitution, honest to God, systematic substitution, to control what we needed. We learned where they were going, and we could do this in high school. And the clue to that was, because it didn't come easy, the clue to that was a visit that I made to Vic Sneekus in Canada. Well, Vic mostly does natural products. And he was one of the people with who were involved in orthomethylation experiments and activated orthomethylation. This is very important methodology. That in fact, I was totally innocent, embarrassingly innocent of it. And although I lectured on synthetic chemistry here all the time, including this reaction, which is in fact critically important to the mathematics, had never happened. And Vic, I have a picture in my mind of Vic presenting this reaction. This is a wonderful reaction, fantastic. What are you doing with this thing? And then as I was thinking about it, I realized that the hybridization of a carbon-hydrogen bond in a cubane is very much like the hybridization of carbon-hydrogen in an aromatic. And the geometry, there are certain similarities in the geometry of course. And of course we can use the cubane and the cubane system, because we enter the cubane system. Yes. And I'm saying that I wonder if it can work with the cubane anode. Well, I came back here. At the time, I had a wonderful postdoc, Graziano Castaldi, a little old, but had many postdocs. And Graziano tried this reaction to direct methylation. Something was happening. And we went round and around in circles for a long time with this. We didn't realize what was going on. That's very pretty work, I must say. We were, in fact, doing the methylation, but only to a very small degree. People like now were significantly less acidic than the benzene hydrogen. And the methylation we were doing was lithiation, and lithium could not get a decent concentration. We had the idea that perhaps we can do a metal exchange. We can go from lithium and mercury. The carbon-mercury bond, of course, is much stronger than the carbon-mercury bond. And so Graziano threw some mercuric chloride into this reaction. Once we had this clue, then we could do it. It took some years to develop it fully. But now it's just fantastic. Example, you take the 1-4 dynamic of cubane, easily made from the end of the cubane series. Instead of lithiation, you do lithiation and then carboxyl. And you get the digrignard, and carboxyl, you get many other things. You get the diamine diester, diacid. And then, of course, you can keep going, you know, you can get the acid.
by this sort of methodology. It's a very beautiful thing. You can do this on cubing monoamide with the other acid group and control what you're adding. You can also distinguish the two acid groups. And it turns out that the substitution problem on the cubing series has really been solved completely. And we could probably make any cubing that one would want. We have eight positions. And we could actually put on the cubing to eight different groups. And of course, there are all sorts of orientations. And I think it's probably made by people, as you can imagine. I'm fond of saying that I think that the substitution chemistry on Cuba is about as well developed as the substitution chemistry on benzene butylate We're a lot further along. In a systematic way. The only thing that we haven't been able to make a lot of Cuba that still is the goal. The nitrocubase has gone on for almost 10 years. And I sort of made a decision that either we get off the nitrocubase within the next 2 years, then we don't know how to do it. We have developed, I think, the fabulous chemistry of getting the tetrahydrocubase. And then the two more pentanes, which we've gotten about a year ago. And these are very nice compounds, just like the armatine. They're very nice. They are shock insensitive, which is also predicted. When they take them and do tests about how effective it is for the blood, right? The results are terrific. So it looks very good. Because of the interest in these compounds, some companies in Italy, Enicam originally, and again because of having many postdocs in Italy, made large quantities of cubane dioxide, 10 kilo quantities. And now it's being made in the country by a small firm here in Chicago called Steroids Limited. They have contracts with the Air Force and so on to make pound quantities of this material, So from a compound which was first made in small amounts on the mantis, things have changed tremendously. And that pleases me very much. And we know, it also pleases me that we no longer have to make the compound not by the field. Another side to the coin, and I think this is always true with organic compounds. You get going on something because you have maybe a particular use or a particular challenge in mind, whatever it happens to be. In this case, to make the nitrocubanes for military purposes. But of course, in the process of learning that you can make the substitution cubanes, you're doing systematic substitution. Now it becomes quite reasonable to think about cubanes that are analytically active. It's an interesting point that the diagonal through the body of the cube, the dimension is the same as the distance in the parabolic fence. Many drugs, probably most drugs, are in fact based on benzene. And of course, the constituents are in the plane of the benzene ring. In the cube, below the plane. This is called the system. And also, you can use the propensity of the cubing systems on the opening positions under certain conditions. And we've been working with a variety of people Silverman and Northwestern. We use ring opening reactions to people called out radical to perhaps be helpful in treatment of Parkinson's disease. It's very impressive results now. Tests that were done here from cancer, it shows the activity of some of these. I think what's been particularly important to me is that the support that the village people have given us to make the nitrocubanes or other high energy cubanes, because they have now a great interest in cubanes as fuels and propellant and things like that. That allowed us really to probe the chemistry of the Cuban system. Then, so we've ended up in really changing the nature of our understanding of chemistry. And we've been able to make such things as Cuban, which is the most parameterized of any elephant known. Almost Cuban, which is a system of elephants known. Cuban cation, which is the least likely cation. Cuban cation forms 10 to the 15th times faster than originally expected. It's a difference between theory and experiment that anyone knows of. And it's really changed the way people think.
Have you arrived at an explanation for that?
Yes, we've worked very closely with theoretical people, most particularly Wes Borden, who has worked with him, and he has developed a very deep understanding of these compounds with the ab initio calculations as to what's going on. And we've had a very, very fruitful interaction over the years. In terms of the calculations, Wes is very good at explaining what the calculations mean and predicting what we did something. And we've been able to make those changes and, in fact, generate proof that evidence for our understanding of the system. Now, of course, Cuba is not the only thing. I mean, Cuba is a very popular compound, and it's a compound that grabs people very easily. I mean, there's no problem remembering the structure of Cuba. You have to remember the structure of strict language, very popular. Cuba is easy. I always feel the military and support Cuba.
Well, you did have a number of other brain target molecule in between your early work in Cubane and your return to the substitute Cubane. Any particular comments about that segment of your research?
This is take two of the interview with Professor Philip E. Eaton on January 22, 1997.
All right. Well, after Cubane, I don't remember exactly the ordering of things, but we were quite interested in propelling molecules to compounds in which two carbons are attached directly together, and then there are three more bridges that connect those compounds, those carbons. And the question is, what happens when the bridges are small? Because the hybridization of the carbon atoms has to change away from sp3 hybridization. And the early questions were, you know, what sort of ring sizes could you make? What would the chemistry be? And we did a nice job on that. Photochemistry was at the heart of it, low temperature photochemistry. We developed nice techniques for doing preparative low temperature photochemistry. And we got down as far as what's called the 222 propelling, which is reactive molecule. It has a half-life of about 20 minutes at room temperature. We got it pure chromatographically, a derivative of it. A student working in a Parker in the cold room here at minus 40 to do the chromatography. And there have been numerous other molecules here in which I think, for the most part, we have been the leaders in the synthesis. The small pad lanes, where now you have four bridges that connect two carbon atoms. The goal here is a molecule whose name is 2-2-2-2 pad lane. So that's two carbons which are connected by four two-carbon bridges. And this is the kind of molecule you can draw on the blackboard and everything looks fine. You start to make a model of it, you realize that it is horrendously strained. And Paul Schleyer, years back, calculated some things about this compound and concluded that this was one of the real values of theoretical chemistry, because it showed absolutely that this was something you shouldn't waste your time trying to make, that experimentally it had no chance of existence. And Paul's probably right on this one. He's wrong on most things, but he's right on this one. The thing is that you can very easily imagine compounds which have three of these two carbon bridges, and then a much longer bridge. And there's no question that molecules like that can be made. And in fact, we've made them. So the question is, what happens when you start to take this big long bridge that's there and make it smaller and smaller and smaller? Right. When the bridge is big, it's fine. When it's down to two carbons, it's impossible. Right. So what goes on in between? And that's exactly the kind of question that I love to answer. I mean, basically, to apply the principle of the homologous series to strain compounds rather than ethane, propane, butane. And so we've been looking at this problem for quite some time, and Buddy Leipzig, probably 15 years ago now, made the smallest of these padalanes to be known. That was three two-carbon bridges and a 10-carbon bridge. Then we ran out of material. And we finally found a graduate student who I've been talking to going further with this. And we're trying now to get to even lower padalanes to answer this fundamental question, what happens? So, I would like to characterize my research as synthetic chemistry that's in search of fundamental answers to problems. In the cubane case, you know, to make cubane and to probe what cubane is like. It's rather a different story than just making a compound and stopping it. And we've learned that that's not enough to do that. There really is reason to examine the compound in more detail. And certainly, since the time that we made cubane, all of the projects that we have taken on have been taken on because we're really asking quite specific questions, like the one I've just said, what happens as the wind gets smaller? And we realize that something has to happen. We can't make a discontinuous transition. Something is going on, and we need to, and nobody really knows what's going on. This 2-2-2-2 padalane that I'm talking about, the theorists have two views of it. Either the carbons at the central positions have are flat, right, or they're pyramidal. Well, I mean, that's some difference. Right? And we need to answer the question, what goes on as you approach this molecule? And I find this is a very nice way of training PhD students and postdocs, because they have to be good in synthetic chemistry, they have to have good hands in the laboratory, which is what organic chemistry is all about. And then nothing replaces being able to do things in the laboratory and to making important observations. So my people have never been just pairs of hands. Pairs of hands are useless to me. They don't make observations. It doesn't get you anywhere. So they do good synthetic chemistry which makes enough material that we can actually examine the chemistry of the product. I'm sure it irritates hell out of my natural products colleagues, but I always say the natural products chemists, I mean, they're making something that's already known. And so they march up to the top of Mount Everest and they just turn around and come back down. My kind of chemistry, we have to climb up to the top of Mount Everest and we have to bring enough stuff with us that we can have dinner. And that's a big difference. Because we really want to examine the chemistry of the molecules. So we can't have syntheses that are too long or have too many pore steps in them or so on. And it goes back to the whole thing about Eric Gilbert. If you can't do it in the 250-milliliter Erlenmeyer, the steam bath is not worth doing. Well, I mean, obviously we don't do that anymore. But the philosophy is the same. That you really have to have a synthesis that's good enough to make enough stuff to study. Otherwise, I can't do the kind of chemistry that I want to do. And the kind of chemistry that I want to do is the physical organic chemistry that I originally thought I was going to find at Harvard, which I didn't quite find. And nowadays, oddly enough, we are looking at some of these questions about what is melting all about? Mm-hmm. How do you change melting patterns? This has become very important amongst the physical chemists, looking at nucleation method of it, you know, what goes on during melting. And some of the molecules that we make actually have important implications here. The symmetry, the high symmetry of cubane makes its phase change very, very interesting. We just have a paper coming out with people of the National Institute of Standards just about this point of what's going on. So it's taken a long time to get around to understanding melting and being part of that. Now, of course, there have been many other adventures in synthetic chemistry, one of which is dodecahedrane. That's one that we did not win. Paquette and Prinzbach, different ways, got there first. I think we really introduced the world to the problem of dodecahedrane. This is a very tough molecule, very interesting molecule. Not strained in the sense of cubane, but a very ordered compound, for which it was quite important to develop new synthetic methodology. And we did that. At the time that we worked on dodecahedrane, there were very few natural products that were known that contained five-membered rings or multiple five-membered rings. That changed dramatically, and this was just fate, that the hirsutine compounds and many other natural products, terpene-type compounds, were isolated that contained fused five-membered rings. The dodecahedrane is a molecule that contains many fused five-membered rings, and we had developed a lot of new methodology for making quinanes, as they were called now, as they were called then, and still called. And that methodology has been translated very nicely into the synthesis of these natural products, not by us, but by others who have used it. We got pretty far in the dodecahedrane problem. Dodecahedrane has 20 carbon atoms. With a very particular orientation, we made the system called peristylane, which has 15 of these atoms, just where they were supposed to be. And the idea was to roof over the peristylane with five more carbon atoms. And in fact, we attached the five carbon component. We got it in the position to roof, but the roof always insists on going on crooked. We can't get it to go on straight. And again, sort of just the way things go. Paquette made a dodecahedrane for the first time, employing at the early stages some of our reactions. His synthesis is an interesting synthesis. It received a lot of criticism for the wrong reason. At the very end, there's sort of a rearrangement that takes you into the dodecahedrane series. And it's a rearrangement that is perfectly reasonable to propose. You should expect it to happen and things of that sort. And people tend to be very critical of one another. And people criticize Leo that this step was an important step. And it was very foolish because this is a step, in fact, was a very logical step for what we knew about physical organic chemistry and so on. And I think Leo deserves a lot of credit for having successfully made this. Prinzbach in Germany was a very good friend, as is Paquette, developed a different method, which is, interestingly enough, based on some of this early chlorocarbon chemistry. It goes all the way back. Mm-hmm. The starting materials are in the chlorocarbons. The Prinzbach method is better than the Paquette method for making material, although neither one of the dodecahedrane syntheses is able to make the kilogram quantities that we can make. It would be irrational to take either of those syntheses and try to make a kilogram of the dodecahedrane. And that's it. It's not a comment on the synthesis, it's a comment on the nature of synthetic chemistry. And I can bring it back, in fact, and make the comment about cubane. There are a couple of very highly specialized cubanes, the octatrifluoromethyl compound and some bridged cubanes, which are made by methods different than the cubane synthesis, the original cubane synthesis. And those compounds are all the Shazam kind of chemistry. And they were made way after the cubane system was made originally. But this is this highly specialized thing that has no real application elsewhere. Our synthesis of the cubane system, its fundamental outline, remains the synthesis of the cubane system. There is no other choice. If it has any conceptual difference from ours. The same thing is true in this dodecahedrane business. I mean, there's two syntheses, the Prinzbach one and the Paquette one, neither one of which capable of high yields and so on. And that's very different than if you take a look at natural products. In the natural product world, where there must be 120 syntheses of many of the compounds. There are at least half a dozen syntheses of cortisone, for example, some good, some bad, and so on and so forth. And the natural products people consider the synthesis, another synthesis of a natural product, presumably a better synthesis of a natural product, as a real goal to pursue. a worthy goal. Well, it probably is a worthy goal, because we're training students and things and such of that sort. That doesn't happen at all in the cubing, the non-natural product area. Sort of each molecule is made, and the challenge is answered, and it's not made again. The chemistry of the molecule, that's not the matter. The chemistry is looked at. But it bothers me very much that the younger generation doesn't look at these non-natural products as synthetic challenges, and they certainly are. Cubane, for example, the hydrocarbon cubane, if the hydrocarbon cubane could be made cheaply, it would really change things tremendously. I mean, cubane has the potential of being a fantastic fuel. Cubane is, in theory, a tetramer of acetylene. And in fact, it's downhill from acetylene. If you could find a way of converting four acetylenes to cubane, that's an energetically favorable process. By comparison to acetylene, cubane is stable. You can't work with acetylene, which, you know, detonates and shock sensitive. Cubane's a rock up until temperatures over 200 degrees. You could tank up on cubane, and it would be fantastic. And in fact, the racing car people have looked at things like this. They recently had to change the rules of the Formula One race in Europe because they were adding things like quadricyclane, and they were about to add things like cubane to the fuel, to make the fuel better than the other guy's fuel. And the old rules are that you could use any fuel you wanted as long as it wasn't more than 130 liters. Now they all have to use the same fuel. That's what's sad. It's terrible. I don't like that at all. I hope this changes. I think there are real challenges in the synthesis of compounds like that, but it's taken a new generation to go after.
Last year in the magazine Harder's Chemical Octa, one of your former students published an article kind of summarizing your career with major emphasis on research. But the latter part of the article had a very high praise for your teaching. Could you comment a bit on your approach or philosophy of teaching?
Well, I don't know exactly how to answer this question. I haven't really put things like this into words before. I think you've seen in some of the things that I told you earlier. They're old stories told many times.
Well, but certainly your interaction with your research students is teaching par excellence.
Well, I think if you're going to be at a university, your first job is teaching. And your first job is not research. It is teaching. Even if you're at a research university, which is what the University of Chicago was about. And I think the chemistry department here, some other departments as well, but certainly the chemistry department here, has always had the tradition that you live up to your responsibilities as a teacher, whether or not you're teaching an undergraduate class or graduate students. And that's a very nice tradition, and it's one that has been reasonably easy to stick with, because until recently the teaching loads have been quite light, the formal teaching loads. That's changing. That's another story that we can perhaps go into some other time. Because of this, I mean, there's a warm feeling amongst the faculty group. There's quite a good collegiality amongst the chemistry faculty here, and there's a warm feeling about teaching. So I mean, at some places I think if you overdo it with teaching, you penalize people. Look at you. You're not doing research first. And here it's recognized that research and teaching are intimately together, and there is no break. Boundary or wall between these two things. The graduate students at the university are a decent group. I can't say they're terrific. Obviously, over the years, I've had some that are really outstanding. I've chosen fairly carefully over the years who I will let in to the group. That has put me in a position that I think over 30-something years here, I have only given 20, 21 PhD degrees. I have colleagues at other universities that I think give that every year. By having a small research group, I'm able to interact with them on a very intimate level, and I think that's what a research advisor should do. I think it's very important in the early stages of a student's PhD degree, in the early stages of his career, that a research advisor really watches what's going on and is counting the drops with him, so to speak. And I think it's very foolish to assume that a student in the laboratory, with the amount of training that we give them as undergraduates anywhere, right, really knows enough to do research or carry out laboratory work. I mean, you can't just say, here's the problem, go do it. Right. Or even worse, pick a problem and go do it. I don't allow my starting students to pick a problem. I tell them what I want them to do. And I always...
Just as Paul Bartlett did with you to begin.
Yes, exactly. And I pick a problem that... Well, I mean, I haven't had a student ever come to me and say, I have this outside problem that I want to do. That I would respond to right away. But I really feel it's important that a student should be given a problem that the research advisor is confident enough about, that when a student comes in and says it doesn't work, or, you know, I can't reproduce this, that you know it does work. Right. And that the problem now is the laboratory training. Right. And you get him over that hump. Right. So that you're confident that when he goes on into the really exploratory world, that when he tells you it doesn't work, you can believe him that it doesn't work. Right. Or at least you don't have to ask him to repeat it 10 times, a few times. But to do this, I think you really have to be connected with what each student is doing. I don't think I'm as good as that now as I was years ago. Time goes on, as you get other kinds of responsibilities, and they become overwhelming. And I think it's interesting that for my 60th birthday celebration, the majority of the students who came back, and the postdocs and so on, were from the old days, way back. Because it's very clear that then I interacted with the students much more personal, intimate level than what I'm able to do now. And I really influenced much more strongly how they thought about science and what they were doing than I can do. Now, I still pay a lot of attention to my students, and they're in here all the time, but different from what it was before. Before, when I was in the laboratory with them, I'm really looking over their shoulders. I enjoyed watching students mature. The man who wrote this article was really a kid when he came, but he matured a lot while he was here, the way that he thought about things and saw the world. It's important to me also that students come and appreciate the outside world. The university is very good, it offers all kinds of opportunities for lectures outside of chemistry and stuff like that, but the city of Chicago is terrific. And I say this as a New Yorker, really is a great city. And it infuriates me. Absolutely, I go up the wall when students come to the university and they just stay here. And we don't go down to the city. And so I've tried every year to take some of my consulting income and buy series tickets for the operas and the symphonies and stuff like that, and the theater, and push my people to go. And I raise hell if I don't go. But I think I should buy tickets for Bulls games. And I won't do that. I mean, that they can do themselves. But, I mean, it's very important to appreciate the city. And this man, Horman, who wrote up that article, and in fact I think arranged for this whole thing, this oral history, he writes about the guy. I sent him to his first opera. And I remember to this day how stunned he was that this existed. It was just an extraordinary experience for him. And of course, I took great delight in that. Mrs. Mendes, a teacher I mentioned from high school, taught me Latin and stuff like that. She took me to my first opera in New York. So that was good. I think it's very nice to work closely with students. I think Chicago is set up that way because our graduate classes tend to be small. I don't think they're small because we want them to be small. We don't really find all the students that we would like to have. The organic group over the years has been really quite small. So it's always been the case that the number of students, the number of PhD students in each group has been small, 3, 4, 5, something like this. There are a few exceptions to this, but they're never huge. They're never like 35 people or things of that sort. I had an exchange years ago with a colleague who I'll leave unnamed at another school, who asked me how many people I had in my research group. And I think at that time I had four graduate students and a few postdocs. And he said, Phil, how did you get any research done? And so I in turn asked, well, how many people are there in your group? And he said, 35. I said, how did you get any teaching done? And I annoyed hell out of him with that question, but I think it was an appropriate question.
Yes.
I have a student now, a young man who I think very highly of intellectually. But I can't get him to stop jumping from reaction to reaction to reaction. And I had him in here today, and I'm finally laying down the law. I said, I'm failing in my duty to you. And this has been going on for 2 years, and you haven't changed at all. I keep yelling that you can't just try a reaction once, and then because you think it doesn't work, try a different version. Another totally different reaction, another totally different reaction. There are 1,000 ways of doing this, and you're just going to try each one once, and you're not sitting down to the nitty-gritty of figuring out how to get it to work, or why, if it doesn't work, why it doesn't work. And he's got until June, or he's out. He's got until June. All he has to do is take this one particular reaction. I said, just choose it. I don't care which one it is that you're proposing. I want you to choose that reaction and stay on that reaction until you can prove to me that you have enough experimental evidence to say that the reaction doesn't work, why it doesn't work. So, I have one very shaken student, but this is, I think, important that you do this, and you just don't let the student drift along and after 5 years give them a degree just because it's over. I think you have to set standards for students. The setting of standards, I think is what all science is about, but certainly it has to be what professors are about.
You made reference a moment ago to relatively modest classroom teaching assignments that have been historically true, perhaps changing now. What is your principal classroom assignment?
I do both undergraduate and graduate teaching, depending on the year. At the University of Chicago, we don't have old-timers, of which I have now become one, assigned to do freshman chemistry or sophomore chemistry year in and year out. We try very hard to avoid that. So some years I'll do undergraduate organic, and some years I'll do an advanced synthesis course. This year, in fact, I'm doing one quarter of each. I normally, at the graduate level, teach things that are involve synthesis. The kind of teaching that we do here is teaching that introduces students very much to an early idea of independence. I give students problem sets that are fundamentally impossible. I tell them they're impossible. But, I don't want them to do the stuff that's easy. The undergraduate teaching at the University of Chicago is very nice indeed. There is a significant number of students that are really very, very good. And there are a true challenge in the classroom to teach, and I enjoy that. And next year, although I've never done it before, and this is the 30-something years here, and I don't think it ever has been done, I'm going to teach 2 quarters of organic chemistry sequentially. We have a quarter system here, and so I'm going to do the the fall and winter quarter sequentially. And it's always been in the past that since the undergraduate organic is quite a load on a person, and, that we've split it up 3 ways, 3 quarters, 3 ways. And the kids hate the winter quarter when they get lots of reactions and things of that sort, and of course the weather is depressing and everything about it is bad. And I just sort of started to wonder what would happen if they took the winter quarter from the same guy they did the fall quarter from, so that it really was a smooth development rather than this fairly jerky thing that occurs. I mean, you never really know what the guy before you has taught, what flair and what flavor he's given everything. And this was just a decision that I reached one day in the shower. and my colleagues were fine, delighted. So we'll see what happens. But I'll only do that for, you know, for a year, and we'll do it as an experiment. And the year after that, since this is a fairly heavy load, I'll probably just do one course or one and a half courses. But it's fun to teach you. But it does. It's taking more and more time, and it does leave one less time to teach at the graduate level. I don't mean the formal teaching, I mean the informal teaching. And clearly that's what graduate education is all about, the informal teaching, the one-on-one interactions, and the change in the amount that one has to teach, and there's the change in all the other paperwork and stuff like that that one has and one goes on. That's distressing. That's a standard complaint I think everybody would make.
Your research accomplishments through your career have been recognized with some awards.
Not very many. I mean, I could be very honest about that. That's one of the problems that I have with my colleagues. And this is rather typical of the University of Chicago. Although there's good interaction amongst people scientifically, there is not much selling of each other. Quite different from other universities.
Mm-hmm.
And as I get older and I see others with many, many more awards, it annoys the hell out of me, to be quite honest. I'm pleased I've just gotten the COPE, one of the COPE Scholar Awards.
Yes.
For 1997. And that pleases me no end. But I must say, I think I should have had a long time ago. I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth, but we might as well be honest.
But you got acknowledgement from overseas anyway with the Humboldt Prize.
Oh, yes, the Humboldt Award was very nice, and I appreciate that very much. And my interactions with German scientists have been very strong because it's been very profitable from the intellectual point of view.
You continued that association after the award was given in 1986.
Right. When the award was initially given, the practice for the Humboldt people was that you would go over to Germany for 9 months or a year. And there was no way I could do that. I didn't want to do it, and I thought that it would be far too disruptive of my responsibilities here. Fortunately, my Humboldt Award was gotten as a collaborative effort from Prinzbach, Vogel, and Adam in Germany, which is a fantastic combination of people. And I told them I just couldn't do it this way. I wanted to break it up. And I would come first for 3 months, do it in 3 month periods. And this was unheard of. But fortunately, I stuck to my guns, and the people were sufficiently powerful that the Humboldt changed the rules. And I did the first time 3 months at Freiburg, and then the 3 months at Cologne, and I decided 3 months was too long. And my wife, who accompanies me, couldn't take being away so long as well. And so the next time we went for 4 weeks, and we did 4 weeks again. And I still got 4 more weeks or something like that to go. So this is why it's gone on over many years. And I think, in fact, it has been very useful that way. And it has become now a modus operandi for the Humboldt. You can go if you want for the 9 months or the 12 months, but it's also possible to split things up. And I think that's very useful. I can't be away for such long periods of time.
You seem to be very effective at changing the rules of operation.
Well, if you're stubborn, some of these rules are rules which got installed years ago when transportation was different, when your responsibilities were different, and so on, and they just don't work nowadays. And I think it's important when they say just say no. You'd be amazed how things change.
To point out the needed corrections. What is your perspective on the future of organic chemistry?
It varies from day to day. It's being in the dumps. To know that organic chemistry is central to, how should I put it, central to continuing. I once read long ago that if agriculture had to both continue feeding all the people on Earth and clothing them, that it couldn't do it. I have no idea if this is really true. I think it probably is. And that was basically without the kinds of things that organic chemistry has brought to agriculture, in terms of insecticides and so on. And more importantly, what organic chemistry has brought to clothing of people in terms of polymers and textiles and stuff like that. And these are enormous changes, fantastic changes. And I don't think they're changes that are really appreciated as such. The physicists have been much better at selling what they do to the population. And I admit the television has changed things in television and physics, but it certainly hasn't changed things the way organic chemistry has changed things. People used to die all the time from simple things, and organic chemistry fixed that. And I think organic chemistry remains just as important as in the past. It really, really is the source of the things that allow a society to continue in some sort of a healthy fashion. I guess what I really think organic chemistry ought to do right now is come along with a good pill for contraception. Because even with the best of intentions, organic chemistry is not going to be able to keep up with the population outrunning things. I'm disturbed about the funding of organic chemistry in the country, but I mean the same complaints, I think, are true for most of science. Things are really turning against invention and research. And that's very sad. I don't think this is a matter of Republican versus Democrat. It has something to do with where the country is going, and its lack of adventurous spirit and there being too many people and so on and so forth. Organic chemistry, I think, is in danger, coming back to the scientific point of view, of becoming a tool, a service for other areas of science, physics, surface studies, biology, molecular biology, things of that sort. And I think it's very important for us not to get overwhelmed by these interfacial activities. You know, organic chemistry is really a very strong discipline, potentially a very strong discipline. It really is a core discipline at the heart of chemistry and at the heart of many other things. And it shouldn't become a service industry. One of my students, graduate students, has just gotten a very good postdoctoral position with a group that deals with polymer chemistry. And I keep telling him, when you go, make sure that you don't become the synthesis chemist in the polymer group. You're going to learn polymer chemistry, so that you're an organic chemist that can both do synthesis chemistry and polymer chemistry. So have all of these things. But the tendency nowadays is to get people buttonholed into little areas. This one does this kind of synthesis, this one does this kind of gene manipulation, or whatever it happens to be. It's not a particularly coherent answer to your
very good answer.
Your question, but...
Let me pose it in a little different way. At each year end, the editor of the New York Times Book Review publishes a list of the 100 most significant books published during the year. Among the list published just over a month ago was The End of Science by John Horgan. And a capsule indication of the book's content read, a bracing argument by a science journalist that the best and biggest discoveries are behind us.
Well, it's like this book, The End of History, which was written right before Russia collapsed and the Soviet Union collapsed. And it's absurd. I confess, I have not read the book, and perhaps it's wrong for me to be critical of it, but I haven't read the book, given the title of the book, because I know there's no chance I'm going to agree with the argument. We're nowhere near the big discoveries. All right, I take my little cubane, my little tiny project here. I told you before, you could change the way human beings fuel their cars and their trucks and everything else if you could discover. And it would really have to be a discovery. This is no minor thing. A real discovery. Mm-hmm. Of how you can make this stuff cheaply. Mm-hmm. And thermodynamically, it's out there. I mean, I know it can be done. Mm-hmm. So that's a fantastic discovery which would change everything. This guy's nuts. I mean, there's an enormous future to science. The problem now is, first of all, there's too many scientists.
far too many. End of the year issue of Journal of Organic Chemistry Carrier came out. I mean, you could barely carry the damn thing. Right? And it's not that there's anything wrong with that, what's in there. It's just the question of why bother, right, with so much of this stuff. Right? And that, I think, is the problem with science. But not the end of science, but there's too much science. Right? And too much of it is trivial. And there's no purpose to it. You don't need to have the 728th way of reducing the ketone. In fact, there's probably 1,000-fold more than that already. And these things tend to get discovered over and over again. And I think we have a problem is that we educate far too many people as scientists. Far too many. Or as semi-scientists, because I think most of the PhDs that are produced in the country really aren't scientists as we understand that. They're hands, technical people. It's even worse in Germany. I don't know if you know this, but Germany is producing more PhDs a year than the United States is, and their population is 70 million versus our about 250. It's crazy.
Well, obviously, science or organic chemistry is appealing to a larger number of persons than you think is appropriate to actually be in the workforce. How does one go about telling them, no, you can't enter your desired field?
Raise the standards. That'll take care of it right away. I mean, I grade my colleagues say, and my students, my undergraduate students say that I grade at a ridiculously hard level. But yet I give exams now like I gave exams 30 years ago, you know, because it's a nice source of exams. You go back to one that 30 years ago, and nobody has that in their records anymore. And they can't answer the questions. I mean, again, except for the top people, and the top people are superb.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a bit, there has been, even when a person like myself who thinks that he's grading by the old standards, I very clearly have inflated my grades going along, being co-opted, that I haven't purposely gone along. I've been trying, I thought, to fight it, but I clearly know I haven't been successful in that. And so more and more people are going into these fields, are, you know, think that they really can come up to the standards of the field, or what I think should be the standards of the field. And they're not. And I think this is certainly true if you take any journal, now be it the best journal or the poorest journal, and you look at the journal and you ask yourself, is it really some importance to doing this? I don't mean importance in the sense that it's solving a societal problem, but a scientific importance. Or is it just an incidental observation that has been inflated far beyond its significance, and a huge amount of time and effort has been wasted looking at this thing? And I think the answer, unfortunately, is that most of this stuff, it doesn't matter if it's been done or not. Or it's already been done before and they may have found the right reference, which is also something that's very common now, because no one can keep up with the literature. I would see education of scientists changed very much. First of all, I would raise the standards. I would raise the standards at the undergraduate level, either by a change in the way that we're grading or really dividing classes into a true honors class where the standards are very high. Most of all, I would like to see a change in how graduate education is done. And I think that the universities in general have done a disservice here with what has happened with master's degrees. At most places, at most of the major universities like Chicago, students are not admitted to master's studies, they're admitted to a PhD. If you want a master's, you can't come here. Students earn a master's degree incidentally here on the way toward a PhD. And those students who don't make it through their first year coursework and things of the sort are fiddled into getting a master's degree, right, because somehow we feel there's some responsibility to give them something. Right. And it's a booby prize. Here. There are a few universities where this is not true. Lehigh, for example, offers, I think, a real master's degree. We know. Most universities give these phony master's degrees. I think that's shameful. Not because the degree is phony, but it could be used in a different way. If I had my druthers, I don't, obviously, but if I had my druthers, I would admit everywhere people to graduate school, qualified people to graduate school, for a master's degree. A master's degree that has laboratory work associated with it, and I think perhaps 2 years of courses. We offer less courses here, and I think that's becoming to be a mistake because chemistry has gotten something. But let's say something, a real master's degree. Right? Not necessarily with a master's thesis, but at least the background. Then you take a look at those people that are here in their second year and decide which of these people have it for going on for a PhD degree. And you take a very small fraction. And I was sufficiently conservative that I would say, I set the fraction in advance, no more than 20%. Mm-hmm. Probably should be less than that, frankly. Mm-hmm. But that should be a hard line. We have to make a decision. Right? Now, so your people don't slide in. Mm-hmm. Now, the master's degree that you give the other 80% is an honest degree, mm-hmm. where they're well-trained, and they can go out into industry. Industry is dying to hire master's degrees. If you have a master's degree now, you're snapped up by industry, a real master's degree. You're snapped up by industry. A PhD can't get a job. A master's degree can do fine. That's what much is what's needed in industry. And educate the rest as PhDs. And those PhDs, I think, would raise the quality of science in the country, not only in the academic world, but in the industrial world. And when they went into the industrial world, those PhDs would then have master's, people who had master's degrees to work with, rather than putting a PhD, this is a top PhD, into industry, right, all alone, right, competing with a whole flock of other PhDs, and competing in a way in which what they have to do is sell their research, right, to management, rather than do it. So that's Eaton solution to the problem.
Well, the Eaton solution would certainly play havoc with your unnamed colleague who wants 35 graduate students.
That's why I think we should wipe that out. I think that I would be delighted. I mean, I know this guy I'm talking about. He's produced wonderful research, but not from 35 people. Right? There are a few people amongst those 35. Who have done that research. The rest are just big pairs of hands. And you could have done all that research with a half a dozen. Not all the research, but the stuff that was worth doing.
One big difference between some European university, Germany, for example, and here, is that there are technicians to work in the university laboratories who are not degree students. Do you think that would be
helpful here? Well, I have a very practical example. Some years back, it's 5 or 6 years ago, the turmoil in Russia and whatnot, May came to work with me as a postdoc from Moscow State University. It turned out to be fabulously good. At the same time, one of his colleagues, who had an equal reputation, went here, of course, he was appointed initially for a postdoc, which is a 2-year appointment. It's possible here to get people to a third-year postdoctoral work with a little bureaucratic fiddling around. And the university is concerned that one keeps people on too long and takes advantage of them, and I think that's a very good concern. This particular man was terrific, and I managed to get him a third year, and I raised his salary very substantially, more than I could afford. But he's terrific. And then I also managed to get him a 4th-year job here, and I could only do that through the university, getting letters from outside as to how good he was and what his contributions were, raising his salary again. And I would not normally have done that, except it was at the depths of the job, the unemployment problem with chemists, and I wanted to make sure I got this man a good job. If I had my druthers, I would have hired him onto the permanent staff, my non-existent permanent staff. But there's no way to do that in the United States. Right? The university obviously can't do it, and you can't do it on soft money and be fair to the person. I mean, an honorable man. Right? And I wasn't going to hire someone who, if my money disappeared, he would have to disappear. So I managed to get him a very good job at Abbott, and he's doing very well there, and so on and so forth. But of course, he's not doing research with me, and he was doing fantastic. This other man in Germany, from the same training and things of this sort, who went with Armin de Meyer, after 2 years, Armin realized, oh, this is a gem, right? And he was hired onto the permanent staff at Göttingen. Mm-hmm. Now, Armin is one of my competitors. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like him very much. But he didn't have any problem, you see, doing this thing. And of course, it's a fantastic deal for both of them, both for Orman and for this other person. And would have been for this man I'm talking about. And I think it's very sad in this country that we cannot do things of this sort, that way we're not set up to do this. And when it does happen in this country, it's when you look at the details, they're awkward, right? And the person is being used. And that, I think, is something we should do. There are remarkable numbers of people who will hire people on soft money, knowing that they're going to have to leave them go when the soft money disappears. They don't seem to give a damn about it. I think that's terrible.
You made reference two or three times to your wife in the course of your comments.
Yes. I'm glad you've given me the opportunity.
Do tell us something about your family.
I worked very hard for a long time, and I was a shy young man. You won't believe that, but I was a shy young man, and I was very bad with girls. And it wasn't until late in life, when I was in my late 30s, that I met my wife, Phyllis. And we struck it off very early on. In fact, I went to a brunch given by a friend. I have no idea why, it's again one of these things that God smiles, because I normally don't go to brunches, particularly when I knew that I was being set up with a blind date. That's not me. Well, I went to this place, I walked in and I saw it, and I fell in love with it. I said, in fact, later on that afternoon, I said, we could save an awful lot of trouble if we just went and got married. Because my father had said to me years ago, one day the doorbell will ring, and you open the door, and that'll be it. And it's exactly what happened, exactly. Extraordinary affair. And so we married now, it's about 20 years. In fact, it will be 20 years in March. We don't have a family. I think my wife would have liked it.
You mean you don't have children?
We don't have children.
We have
a family. We have a very close family between the two of us and a dog. A very big dog we both love. I was probably selfish that way. I didn't want to share. I'm not big on sharing. Anyhow, Phyllis is just a wonderful woman. I said at my 60th birthday, since I had to say something at the end, it was very difficult for me because that's the kind of situation where I choke up very easily. I have a lot of trouble getting this out. But I thanked all kinds of people. You know, I think I said something about thanking my colleagues for teaching me how to be a scientist, and thanking my students for teaching me how to be a teacher. I'm having trouble. I thank Phyllis for teaching me how to be a person. That's very much how I feel about it. Wonderful woman.
Is she employed outside the home?
She is a psychotherapist. She has a private practice in psychotherapy. When I met her, her expertise was in child psychotherapy, so it fit perfectly. I was prepared to move in. Since then, we always travel together, and it's too difficult to teach to treat children under that circumstance because they don't understand things like this. So she now does just adult psychotherapy, and her practice is very small now. It's unnecessary. She just does it to keep her hand in. But she's on the faculty of the Chicago Institute for Psychoanalysis and does some teaching. It's very important. Slowly learning things about Cuban chemistry, which she actually enjoys. And I have come to respect psychotherapy from a position of substantial disrespect. I follow her patients and her chit-chat about the patients, and it's very interesting to see how effective this is. And I also see how much I've changed in 20 years. She's very effective. Very effective. Very special person.
Is there anything else that you would like to have to complete the recording?
I don't know. It's difficult to say. I have a lot of people to thank over the years, of course, ranging from Mrs. Mendes and early science teachers to F. Gilbert and lots of people. And, you know, everybody has an impact on you in one way or another. Clearly, the adventure with students has covered the gamut of emotions. Absolutely. Oh my God, what am I going to do with this one? How do I get him out of here? To realizing that the student has the potential to be better. than you are. It's been fun. And I say good things about the University of Chicago and this department. I think things are changing in ways I don't like. I have a feeling part of that is just getting older. But part of it is real. Science? Yeah, I guess there's one thing I would say about science. And probably one of the biggest arguments that I have here with my colleagues. The majority of my colleagues, particularly the people of my age, are not attuned at all to the practical aspects of their science. I am attuned to it, which I think, again, has to do with his early experience with Allied Chemical and being raised in a business family and things of the sort. I probably have somewhat more concern about wanting to be wealthy than my colleagues. Wanting and being are two very different things. But I've always thought that many of the people here, and I think many of the scientists elsewhere, don't understand that you can add to the intellectual adventure by trying to do things which are fundamental and also have practical implications. It's not an either or situation. And too many of my colleagues and too many others feel that it is. I take an example from natural product synthesis because I'm always teasing the natural product chemists. I think the natural product people have proven that they can make most anything. They haven't proven that they can make most anything cheaply. So why not make part of the intellectual adventure the synthesis of a compound cheaply? And it's very easy to come up with an example. Things like quinine are yet to be made cheaply. And because of that, they can't be used in the third world. Now, I'm not big on saving the third world. I got no population. But there's a reason for it, if you need a reason. I'm amazed that I got into this octanitrocubane business for a quarter practical application. Again, I'm not big on blowing up the world, but that's where it came from. And the support came from it. And I think my colleagues, to a degree, look down on that kind of support because it has, besides the military thing, which is already a no-no, but it has, this practical application. But in fact, pursuing that practical application opened up the entire world of Cuban chemistry in a way that never would have happened before. So I think it's important see these two things, the intellectual challenge and the practical, the fundamental science and the practical science, as a unit. And the science has moved to the point where it's not enough to just say it's interesting to do this or it's fun to do this. We've already proven that it's interesting to do it and it's fun to do it. You can have the other thing as well. Now, I don't want you to interpret this as support for what is happening now in the government, which is saying that the mission orientation, the goal, is the only thing that's important, and that the science that goes into the goal, they don't care. So they set a goal to cure AIDS, fine, or to cure cancer, whatever it happens to be. I mean, these are all admirable goals, but there are certainly no excuses for funding crappy science. And that's what's happening. And that's why there are so many scientists, because there's so much of this money around to fund stuff which is, forgive the expression, just sheer crap. It's a ripoff on the society. It's a ripoff on science. And I don't think that. And it's being fostered not only by the government, but by a lot of scientists who are covering their behinds. Long ago, I established that I could be very irritating. I suppose that has stayed with me. In the 60s, I was asked to join an NIH study section. I was integrating it because I was the young person on it. I was young then. And there was a threat of a cutback of money for the NIH. And I, of course, But I was ruthless on this thing. I mean, I didn't think that anything that was half-assed science should be funded. And my colleagues didn't agree with that. And when it came to this this cutback that was going to happen, I thought this was just a marvelous opportunity. It was a 10% cutback, so you should just cut off the bottom 10%. It seemed to me totally obvious. And it was probably easy to identify the bottom 10%. There was no problem with that. This is my colleagues, my old senior colleagues, said, oh, no. We'll all take a 10% cut. It's very important to maintain this bottom layer as an insulation, and so they don't get to you. Now, I thought this was just horrible. I never got back on the panel. I served my 4 years, and at that time, actually, the thing is still posted on my bulletin board. Miller Beer, or one of the beers, came out with these little coasters. Chad, I think it was Miller Beer. But the expression on the coaster was, only you can prevent mediocrity. And I left one of these at each of the stations at the NIH. That's something you're not forgiven for. I show you, it's still outside. The Miller Beer part's gone, but the only you can prevent mediocrity is that. And I believe that. I really believe that. And that's what's wrong with science, is there's not enough. There's wrong with many things, not just science, politics, the whole shebang. There's people are just unwilling to say. There's no need for this mediocrity. Perfectly fine, have average people doing average things, but there's no reason to say that average people have to do the top things. Or at least what we consider to be the top things. There are a set of top things, and that's one. I believe very much that the top carpenter, deserves the same credit as the top scientist. The top craftsmen, and so on. It's the people that are at who are paid for being lousy. That's what I object to. That puts it in a nutshell, I suppose.
Thank you for being so generous with your time to tell us about your illustrious career.